Lucas recognized that Darth was a strong character, having grown much since the first and second drafts, and now surviving the end battle. Even Lucas did not intend for the character to be so popular. Audiences love Darth Vader, and his mysterious nature made him all the more intriguing. Who was he? What did he look like underneath? Was he a human or an alien?
"Darth Vader became such an icon in the first film," Lucas said. "That icon of evil sort of took over everything, much more than I intended."
The popularity of the character suddenly thrust him into a completely unintended status of celebrity, and therefore it became paramount to not only give him more screen time for the next film, but to expand on his mythos. This is why Darth is merely a rather minor henchman in Star Wars, but becomes an all-powerful central character for the sequel, one who seemingly controls the Empire and is feared by all, as opposed to Star Wars, where he is talked down to by everyone from Princess Leia to Imperial officers, and has only 9 minutes of combined screen time. One thing was clear: Darth Vader had to be a major part of Star Wars II. But what was Star Wars II? Lucas had a wealth of material on the events which occur before the first film. He had notes on the structure of the Old Republic, the Jedi Order, the Emperor's rise to power, the downfall of the galaxy, and the beginning of the Civil War, with Darth Vader's betrayal of Obi-Wan Kenobi and Father Skywalker occurring at the history's climax. A storyline detailing Obi-Wan's adventures with Father Skywalker would make an interesting film, and now that he was the most successful director of all time, Lucas entertained the possibility of one day portraying this in a sequel. Contrary to popular belief, Star Wars was not designed with these prequels in mind, but rather they were added as afterthoughts, as can be clearly seen. Lucas admitted in a 1997 interview,
"After the first film came out and suddenly was a giant hit, I said, 'Oh, I get to do these two movies.' Everyone said, 'What else are you going to do?' I said, 'Gee, I could do these backstories too. That would be interesting.' That's where the eventual idea of starting in Episode 4 came from, because I said, 'Well, maybe I could make 3 out of this backstory.' That evolved right around the time the film was released, after I knew it was a success."
Lucas first publicly considered making a sequel about the young Ben Kenobi in the late summer of 1977. He told Rolling Stone in August,
"I have sequel agreements with all the actors except Alec Guinness. We may use his voice as the Force, I don't know. One of the sequels we're thinking of is The Young Days of Ben Kenobi. It would probably be all different actors."
Unfortunately, making a Young Days of Ben Kenobi film would require completely new casting, as well as building an entirely new world, one which was much grander and special effects driven than the more small-scale one he was currently engrossed in. Perhaps he could do this story sometime later, but for now he needed an immediate sequel to Star Wars. Making a follow-up to Star Wars left Lucas with a lot of possible routes to travel. Conveniently, because the story was an ensemble cast, if one of the actors refused a sequel, they could be easily written out. Although Luke was clearly the main character in the film, with the series known as The Adventures of Luke Skywalker, a spin-off or sequel had the potential to follow Han, Leia, or new characters on the Rebel Alliance, and Lucas was smart enough to have the villain escape at the end. Lucas said in 1977,
"It was one of the original ideas of doing a sequel that if I put enough people in it, and it was designed carefully enough, I could make a sequel about anything. Or if any of the actors gave me a lot of trouble, or didn't want to do it, or didn't want to be in the sequel, I could always make a sequel without one."
Star Wars was a hit, but to Lucas, it was still a frustration. It didn't turn out the way he had envisioned it.
"Star Wars is about 25% of what I wanted it to be. It's really still a good movie, but it fell short of what I wanted it to be," he told Rolling Stone in 1977.
The process of making the film wore him out. He admitted himself to the hospital on one occasion, fearing a heart attack, and was diagnosed with hypertension and exhaustion. Directing the next ones no longer enticed him. He directed Star Wars mostly because he had to, because no one else would have wanted to.
I hate directing, he told Rolling Stone in 1980. It's like fighting a 15-round heavyweight bout with a new opponent every day. You go to work knowing just how you want a scene to be, but by the end of the day, you're usually depressed because you didn't do a good enough job.
Now, however, he could have others do the dirty work for him. Lucas could write the scripts, finance the film, and supervise the project, while someone else could do the more tedious work, in Lucas's mind, of actually being on set and filming the material. With an unlimited number of possible adventures, he could turn it into a bona fide franchise, having new directors have their go in the Star Wars galaxy, each making their own version of it, like a space opera version of James Bond. The adventures could be more standalone types like the first film, or could also slowly develop themes and storylines throughout the series, and end in cliffhangers, like the serial episodes the movies were inspired by, or perhaps even follow side characters and different time periods. His contract only stipulated a trio of films, but with Star Wars quickly becoming the most popular film ever made, his plans for it were growing as well. In the 1977 television special, The Making of Star Wars, as told by C-3PO and R2-D2, producer Gary Kurtz stated the following.
We've had a lot of speculation about sequels to Star Wars, and we are working on story material that will develop into potentially one or more motion pictures that will use the same characters. I like to consider them different adventures rather than direct sequels.
Mark Hamill echoed that sentiment in a June 1978 article in Science Fiction magazine. They always wanted to set up their own little James Bond series, taking the environment George has set up but keeping it limitless in terms of what the characters can do. For the sequel, he's going to add new characters. It won't be a direct sequel to the first story. It'll be a series of adventures, you know, in that galaxy. If the Star Wars series runs as long as I think they're going to run, I will be Ben Kenobi's age when I do the last one.
Unlike the contemporary view of Star Wars, the series was not planned as an elaborate, self-contained story divided in 6 chapters. It was to be in the vein of adventure theater, with different adventure-of-the-week type of films. And even the time periods of the films could differ and be presented in a non-linear fashion. As Alan Arnold wrote in 1979, Gary Kurtz described Star Wars II as a new chapter in the Star Wars saga, because the intention is never to refer to it as a sequel, for the simple reason that future George Lucas stories do not have chronological sequence. Now armed with a bigger budget and more resources at his disposal, Lucas could let his friends have their chance to play in the world and make something out of it, and the series could endure for as long as Lucas wanted it to. He said in a 1977 conversation with Paul Scanlon,
I think the sequels will be much, much better. What I want to do is direct the last sequel. I could do the first one and the last one and let everyone else do the ones in between.
It wouldn't bother you to have someone else do the ones in between?
No, it would be interesting. I would want to try and get some good directors and see what their interpretation of the theme is. I think it will be interesting. It is like taking a theme in film school. Say, okay, everybody do their interpretation of this theme. It's an interesting idea to see how people interpret the genre. It's a fun genre to play with. All the prototype stuff is done now. Nobody has to worry about what a Wookiee is and what it does and how it reacts. Wookiees are there. The people are there. The environment is there. The empire is there. I put up the concrete slab of the walls, and now everybody can have fun drawing the pictures and putting on the little gargoyles and doing all the really fun stuff. And it's a competition. I'm hoping if I get friends of mine, they will want to do a much better film. Like, I'll show George that I can do a film twice that good. And I think they can, but then I want to do the last one, so I can do one twice as good as everybody else.
Mark Hamill was gladly aboard for more than his contract, as he told a 1978 issue of Gossip magazine. I'm definitely going to do 2 more, and they have asked me to do a 4th one, and at this point, I can't see any reason why I wouldn't. I haven't signed for it yet, but it is a really exciting thing for me, and I think for everybody involved. In the excitement of the film's enormous success, Lucas had let his Adventures of Luke Skywalker trilogy dissolve into a massive franchise to explore the galaxy he had created. The film had become the biggest hit of all time, and Lucas was going to take advantage of it. His idea for a filmmaker's center needed the funding of more than just the profits of one or two hit movies. It needed the strength and stability of a mega-hit franchise behind it in order to pay for its annual million-dollar overhead, and Lucas found himself in the position to provide that. The initial plan was that the series was infinite, but by 1978, after actual development on the future storylines was done, a numerical figure was attached, as we shall examine in the next chapter. Most fans will tell you Lucas had 6 episodes planned, and the most astute ones will correct you that it was 9 episodes, with the fabled sequel trilogy that never was following the original 3. But Lucas initially envisioned 12 films. Time magazine reported in 1978, Lucas has set up 4 corporations. Star Wars Corp. will make Star Wars 2, and then, count them, 10 other planned sequels. In the same article, Lucas says that because of the 11 sequels, it will take 23 years of constant filming to produce them all, with 2001 as the projected date of completion. Lucas's comments on the sequels are wildly contradictory at times, with his plans changing drastically as actual story development was made, as we shall examine in the next chapter. To sum up the problem, it boils down to Lucas simply being excited by the recent success of Star Wars, and talking about huge numbers of sequels without any concrete plans or ideas. Why 12 episodes, one might ask? Star Wars was to be an adventure serial, which traditionally lasted for 12 episodes or chapters. It is no surprise that all of the 1930s serials Lucas loved, like Flash Gordon, Buck Rogers, The Fighting Devil Dogs, and The Phantom Empire, were all 12 episodes long. The 12-parter was a staple of the serial formula, and in trying to emulate those films as closely as possible, Lucas naturally decided that The Adventures of Luke Skywalker would also have to run for 12 episodes.
This was done in the style of a 1930s Saturday matinee serial, which were usually in 12 episodes, Lucas has said.
Seeking a franchise to fund Lucasfilm for many years to come, 12 films also happened to fit the requirements. The 12-episode plan was touted over and over again, many times in Lucasfilm's own official newsletter, Bantha Tracks. In issue 2, based on the second of 12 stories in George Lucas's Adventures of Luke Skywalker's series, the first draft of the screenplay of Empire Strikes Back was written by Lee Brackett. And again in issue 3, the sequel will be based directly on the second of 12 stories George Lucas wrote in The Adventures of Luke Skywalker. We see an early example of the sort of misconception about the story which the public was being influenced by. Rather than claiming to have stories for all 6 episodes, as most are used to hearing, here it is claimed that Lucas has already written stories for 12. This form of exaggeration was perhaps used as a hype ploy, to stimulate interest in what appeared to be an already written epic that was slowly being revealed. These quotes also demonstrate the significant period in the franchise's early public life, before it had officially become known as Star Wars. The change may have been fostered by marketing forces. Before the sequel gained its official title, it was known simply as Star Wars 2, and the series commonly referred to as the Star Wars series, leaving The Adventures of Luke Skywalker to gradually fade away. The last official mention of the 12-part saga is in the 6th issue of Bantha Tracks, in autumn of 1979. Overseeing it all are director Irvin Kershner and executive producer George Lucas, making sure that every phase of production keeps to his vision for the entire 12-part saga. The next time a numeric figure is officially attached to the films is the 8th issue of Bantha Tracks, from spring 1980. George Lucas addressed the issue personally. Bantha Tracks. Star Wars. At one point, there were going to be 12 Star Wars films. George Lucas.
I cut that number down to 9 because the other 3 were tangential to the saga. Star Wars was the 4th story in the saga. After the 3rd film, we'll go back and make the first trilogy, which deals with the young Ben Kenobi and the young Darth Vader.
In reality, Lucas never had a real story arc until he fused the characters of Darth Vader and Father Skywalker, thus creating the prequel trilogy, and setting Star Wars up as the 4th film in a 9-film series. This will be the focus of the next chapter. Regardless, Lucas had to get to work on the sequels and figure out just how many he would actually be making. He didn't start working on the story to Star Wars 2 until the end of 1977, being preoccupied with the success of his film and trying to get a firm grasp on his 2 new companies, Lucasfilm and ILM, moving them from Van Nuys to Marin County, California. He had also followed through on the agreement he made with Spielberg in Hawaii earlier that year for Raiders of the Lost Ark. Spielberg had been impressed with a screenplay he read by a young Chicago copywriter named Lawrence Kasdan, and in late 1977 hired him to script the project. Lucas also began dreaming up Skywalker Ranch at this time, a concept which had grown out of the elaborate Lucasfilm headquarters developed at Lucas's Parkhouse home, as a sort of filmmaker's paradise that was to be a communal resource center and think tank. The means of creating this compound required huge sums of money, far more than Star Wars had afforded him.
"He took me into a workroom,"
Irvin Kershner remembers in Mythmaker.
"And on the wall were plans for Skywalker Ranch. He said, 'This is why we're making the 2nd Star Wars film. If it works, I'll build this. If it works, we'll not only build it, we'll make more Star Wars. If it doesn't work, it's over.'"
The Star Wars franchise was built as a means to fund more personal, uncommercial projects, similar to his student films, which he would make with the aid of his research center, eventually dubbed Skywalker Ranch.
"When I was in film school, I was into a very abstract kind of filmmaking. I want to get back to it," he told Alan Arnold in 1979. "Which brings me again to the research center. That is really the core of my drive to make this work. Movies cost a lot of money. You can't just go out and make them, no matter how rich you are. You have to devise a mechanism, a funding machine, that will allow you to make movies. Now I want to use it to make the kind of films I'm interested in, regardless of their commerciality."
He began thinking about ideas for the new Star Wars film. As fall of 1977 approached, Star Wars mania began to subside as kids went back to school and Lucas's corporate restructuring began to take shape. It was time to finally tackle the writing of the Star Wars sequel. Lucas had a lot of story points to address and develop. One of them was an expansion on the Force itself, and with it both Obi-Wan and the Jedi. Unlike Empire Strikes Back and Return of the Jedi, Obi-Wan's spirit was a much more ethereal and subtle addition to the first film. In fact, it was mostly unplanned, as Obi-Wan's death was written into the original film while shooting. Lucas told Rolling Stone in 1977,
"I was struggling with the problem that I had this sort of dramatic scene that had no climax about 2/3 of the way through the film. I had another problem in the fact that there was no real threat in the Death Star. The villains were like tenpins. You get into a gunfight with them and they just get knocked over. As I originally wrote it, Ben Kenobi and Vader had a sword fight, and Ben hits a door and the door slams closed, and they all run away and Vader is left standing there with egg on his face. This was dumb. They run into the Death Star and they sort of take over everything and they run back. It totally diminished any impact the Death Star had. Anyway, I was rewriting, I was struggling with that plot problem, when my wife suggested that I kill off Ben, which she thought was a pretty outrageous idea, and I said, 'Well, that is an interesting idea, and I had been thinking about it.' Her first idea was to have 3PO get shot, and I said impossible because I wanted to start and end the film with the robots. I wanted the film to really be about the robots and have the theme be the framework for the rest of the movie. But then the more I thought about Ben getting killed, the more I liked the idea because, one, it made the threat of Vader greater. And that tied in with the Force and the fact that he could use the dark side. Both Alec Guinness and I came up with the thing of having Ben go on afterward as part of the Force.
In Star Wars, Obi-Wan is represented by a voice which only Luke can hear. In fact, he himself is not even sure if he is hearing it. The use of the voice is a way to cinematically represent that Obi-Wan will always be with Luke, that his mentor will always be with him in spirit. Empire Strikes Back and Return of the Jedi obviously took a different route, as Obi-Wan actually materializes and has conversations, but the whole story point surrounding his death and the Force itself was never supposed to be so literal. As Lucas said in the 1977 interview with Rolling Stone,
"We may use his voice as the Force, I don't know."
Although the second draft of Star Wars portrayed it as a more comic book-like superpower, the simplified third and especially fourth draft would present the Force in a very ambiguous way, essentially being a metaphor for believing in yourself. Luke succeeds because he believes he can. He uses the Force because he simply believes, and it gives him the strength to triumph. It was in this way, this intangible, metaphorical way, that the film addressed issues of God and the supernatural, by refuting cynics through the notion that seeing comes from believing. The sequels would basically do away with this more mysterious, unprovable view of the Force in favor of the original literal superpowers. Han would hardly be able to doubt the Force as he did in Star Wars if the ghost of Ben Kenobi materialized and levitated him off the ground. When Luke reached out his hand in the opening sequence of Star Wars II, suspended upside down in the Wampa lair, and his lightsaber began to quiver before it leapt into his grasp, a new threshold had been crossed in which the Force became a material superpower. Lucas dreaded returning to the writing process, which he has described as painful and tedious. For Star Wars II, he turned to Lee Brackett. Brackett was a legendary writer of pulp science fiction in the 1940s and 50s, a writer of crime novels, and screenwriter for Howard Hawks. Their pairing seemed like a natural formula for success. In fact, her husband was Edmond Hamilton, also a noted science fiction author, whose story, Kaldar, Planet of Antares, published in Weird Tales magazine in 1933 and reprinted in paperback in 1965, has been thought to have been an influence in the development of the lightsaber since it featured one. Hamilton's version was called a lightsword. Brackett was brought to Lucas's attention by a friend, who handed him an old science fiction novel and said, "Here is someone who wrote the cantina scene in Star Wars better than you did." He contacted the elderly Brackett, who was living in Los Angeles at that time, and asked her to write Star Wars II.
"Have you ever written for the movies?"
Lucas asked her. "Yes, I have," Brackett replied simply. She began recounting her credits, which included Rio Bravo, El Dorado, and The Big Sleep, co-written with William Faulkner, the Nobel Prize-winning novelist. An awkward silence followed.
"Are you that Lee Brackett?"
Lucas gasped. "Yes," she replied. "Isn't that why you called me in?"
"No," Lucas said. "I called you in because you were a pulp science fiction writer."
On November 28, 1977, Lucas handwrote the Star Wars II story treatment. The film was titled The Empire Strikes Back. Chapter 5 Revelations. Unlike Star Wars, the early drafts of The Empire Strikes Back were largely similar in construction. The film starts off on the ice planet. The rebel base is invaded, and the group of heroes splits into two. Luke trains with Jedi Master Yoda, while Han and Leia are pursued and captured, and eventually they all meet back on Bespin, where Luke faces Darth Vader. Lucas wanted to retain the serial feel of Star Wars, with constant peril for the heroes. Luke is attacked by a beast in the film's opening and escapes from the creature's lair only to be stranded in a snowstorm. After being rescued by Han, the rebel base comes under attack by Imperial forces, and the rebels flee, with Luke traveling off to train as a Jedi, and Han and Leia being pursued by Darth Vader and his minions. It was a tight script. On the same date as Lucas's November 28th story treatment, he and Lee Brackett began having story meetings until December 2nd, where many ideas for the film were developed. The timeline of the early development of Empire Strikes Back is a somewhat tricky subject. According to personal correspondences, the Magic of Myth Smithsonian exhibit presented the treatment as being a result of the story conferences, and not the other way around, for example, as is the case with Return of the Jedi. The treatment is actually a culmination of the story conferences. This is the way it was presented in the Smithsonian exhibit. It served as kind of a roadmap for other parts of the exhibit. Even though the treatment I saw was typed up, it actually started out as Lucas's own handwritten notes from the conferences. The reason why it has the same date as the start date of the conferences is the same reason why a student's calculus notes might have a date attributed to them, to document the day that person took those notes. November 28, 1977 was the first day Lucas started taking notes. As a result, this is the date that gets attached to his treatment. This is given credence by the development of Yoda. Laurent Bouzereau, in the annotated screenplays, states that the creature's existence was first proposed in story conferences and was known only as the Critter. In the treatment, Lucas finally names him Minch Yoda. This is the main piece of evidence. If Yoda was already in the November 28th treatment, then how could he have been developed in the supposedly subsequent conferences? Thus, the treatment came second. The reason for the treatment bearing the same date as the first day of the conferences might be extrapolated from the annotated screenplays. The opening scene was discussed at length by Lucas and Brackett. A helicopter shot would reveal two men riding the snow dunes on some kind of giant snow lizard. One guy calls to the other on his walkie-talkie but can't reach him. He hears all kinds of weird sounds. His friend eventually replies and says he's okay, but suddenly a beast attacks and kills him. The other man gets back to the base and reports that his friend has disappeared. Lucas, having the opening sequence vividly in his mind, must have put it to paper directly after the very first story conference of November 28th, upon which he annotated it with that date, turning the two anonymous characters into Luke and Han, but then withheld writing the rest of the treatment until later in the conferences, or after they were complete, by which point more elements of the storyline had been decided upon. This is similar to the way the conferencing and treatment of Raiders occurred only a few months later, in early 1978. Lucas met with writer Lawrence Kasdan and director Steven Spielberg beginning on January 23, 1978, which lasted until January 27th. But the Raiders of the Lost Ark treatment bears a date of January 25th, right in the midst of the conferencing. According to Laurent Bouzereau, during story meetings, Brackett and Lucas decided that the Emperor and the Force had to be the two opposing issues in the film. The Emperor was virtually non-existent in Star Wars, and now he would be dealt with in person. However, he was still a Nixonian bureaucrat at this point, described as a Wizard of Oz-type person, a master manipulator. In story meetings, it was decided that Vader would also be shown in a black castle surrounded by lava, with gargoyles and gremlins. This frighteningly powerful imagery is indicative of the transformation Darth Vader had undergone since Star Wars was released, a far cry from the petty bickering with Tarkin in the first film. Later, the Emperor has a discussion with Vader on a communication screen. The Emperor is described as caped and hooded in a cloth of gold, and says that he has felt a disturbance in the Force due to Luke's Jedi training. Joe Johnston did sketches of Vader's castle, but before he got too far, Lucas said that he would be saving this for future episodes. The development of Yoda was a major addition to the series. Obi-Wan wasn't the last of the Jedi after all, and in fact, his former master is still in hiding. Laurent Bouzereau wrote in the annotated screenplays, "The idea of using another person, perhaps an alien, for Luke to play off of, came up during story meetings. George Lucas and Lee Brackett thought that the alien could be an Indian desert type, very childlike, even though he's an old man. He at first should be repulsive and slimy, but then should become kind and wise. He appears as a crazy little nitwit that goes around scurrying like a rat, but ultimately teaches Luke a great deal about the Force. This description sounds similar to the original conception of Ben Kenobi from the third draft of Star Wars, where he is portrayed as crazed and childlike until Luke realizes that he is the great Jedi Master he is looking for. But with Ben dead and gone, Lucas had to introduce a substitute. Minch Yoda, as he was later called, says that he knew Obi-Wan and Father Skywalker, and that they used to train on the Bog planet. In the story conferences, the frog-like appearance was decided upon. It was suggested that he should be very small, about 28 inches high, Boozero reported. He should be slightly frog-like, with slick skin, a wide mouth, no nose, bulbous eyes, thin spidery arms. He should have a rounded body with short legs, but very large, floppy, webbed feet. Basically, he would have the personality of a Muppet, only with almost human and realistic behavior. At that point, Yoda did not have a name and was referred to as the Critter. Boozrow also reported that Lucas and Lee Brackett had lengthy discussions about Luke's training with Yoda, and decided to turn the lessons into proverbs or commandments. Through the lessons, Luke should learn to respect Yoda, and Yoda should realize that the boy is a great warrior. There was also more elaboration on what the Force was and how it functioned. It was decided that learning the ways of the Force had to be a constant struggle for Luke, and that he would always have to prove himself. In regard to the dark side of the Force, the story meeting transcript suggests that although one can't see it, it should be the real villain of the story. In his training, Luke discovers the roots of the evil Force. The danger, the jeopardy, is that Luke will become Vader, will become taken over. He has to fight the bad side and learn to work with the good side. Lucas felt that at one point during the training, Ben should explain to Luke that he should use his powers with moderation. If he uses too much of the Force, it will start using him. For example, to lift objects, Luke has to use the bad side of the Force. So if he overuses this power, the dark side will start taking him over, as it did with Vader. When Luke fights, he has to use the dark side, but he is also using the good side for protection. In this episode, Luke should embody the classic tale of the ugly duckling who becomes a hero. And by the end of the film, Luke should have become Ben. In addition to the ice planet Hoth, many more planets were brainstormed in story conferences, including a water planet with an underwater city, a fairy tale-like garden planet, and a city planet that might be the home of the Empire. Boozrow described new developments for Han Solo. Many changes in Han's character were discussed during story meetings. In coming up with a possible mission for Han, George Lucas fleshed out the character's backstory. Han is an orphan and was raised by Wookiees on their planet. He left, flunked out of the Space Academy, and then met some kind of Ernest Hemingway character, a very powerful trader in the galaxy, who took Han under his wing until they had a falling out. Han swore he'd never talk to him again. When the story begins, the Rebel Alliance needs this man, this powerful traitor, on its side. By now, he controls all non-military transports in the galaxy, and is the head of some sort of transport guild. Leia tells Han that they've made contact with him, and that he'll talk only to him. Another plot line suggests that Han is the only one who knows where this man is hiding, and that the Rebellion wants Han to contact him. In either case, the future of the Rebellion is in Han's hands. At first, Han refuses to go, but eventually he agrees to take on the mission, although it is aborted once the Empire attacks the Rebel base. This subplot would be left out of Lucas's treatment, but Brackett would incorporate it into her first draft. Lando was also first discussed in story meetings as a new Han Solo character. Bouzereau describes the many ideas bandied about for Lando. He is described as a slick, riverboat gambler dude. Unlike Han Solo, this guy should be elegant, sort of like James Bond. There were discussions about getting this new character a sidekick, a girl or female alien, or a matched set of girls. Another permutation had Lando be a gambler who runs a general store on the Wookiee planet, or a trader, some sort of businessman who works with smugglers. A bit of development on the mysterious Clone Wars was then done. A final idea proposed was that Lando was a clone. Laurent Bouzereau reported in the annotated screenplays, Leia doesn't trust him because of the war that practically wiped out his species. He could be one of the last clones, and in another episode he could run across a clan of clones who are all exactly like him. He came from a planet of clones. The planet had maybe 700 different countries, and each country was composed of a clone clan, and he was the ruler of one of the clans. This would be incorporated into the treatment and first draft, but then dropped from the story. Ideas for the climactic fight between Vader and Luke were developed in the story meetings as well. Luke had to be trained as a good swordsman so that it would pay off in his fight with Vader. Bouzereau described the challenge as playing the fight like a seduction, a temptation. The audience knows that Luke is not going to die, so the ultimate hook is the fear that Luke might turn to the dark side. Bouzereau also reported, the idea of Vader using telekinetic powers during his fight with Luke was created during story meetings. There was concern, however, that the audience might think back to the first film and wonder why Vader didn't use all his powers on Ben. This was easily explained by the fact that Ben was probably stronger than Vader. George Lucas and Lee Brackett also discussed the different levels of the Force. Maybe Ben was a 6, Vader was a 4, and Luke is now at level 2. Another idea that came out of story meetings was to have Luke wedged up against a wall. There's a pipe next to him, and Vader and Luke duel, trying to bend it until it buckles and ties itself up. With the basic backbone of the movie now developed, Lucas fleshed out a treatment. Written by hand, the 19-page treatment is crude and briskly developed, with many spelling and grammar mistakes, representing Lucas's first thoughts on the story. The story treatment for Empire Strikes Back began as the film does, with Luke being attacked by the Wampa. This has been theorized to have been written due to the fact that Mark Hamill was in a rather serious car accident in 1977, which resulted in some plastic surgery to correct his facial structure. Thus, the scarring Luke endured was used to explain his subtly altered appearance, though the fact that Lucas had this scene in mind before it was attached to Luke seems to put this theory in doubt. Lucas's treatment begins thusly. Open on the bleak white planet of Hoth, Luke is riding across the wind-swept ice slopes on a large snow lizard, Tauntaun. He reins up on the shaggy two-legged creature when he spots something on the horizon. A strange ice formation or meteorite hit. Luke talks into his walkie-talkie, which is on his helmet. He lifts his snow goggles as he says, Han, old buddy, everything's okay here, but I saw a glint on the next ridge, and I want to check it out. Over the comlink, we hear Han say, Okay, but don't take too long, kid. Night storm's coming up. Luke says a few kind words to his lizard, sinks his spurs in, and the beast leaps forward. He rides over the ridge when suddenly, out of nowhere, a giant snow creature jumps up in front of him, causing the lizard to rear back and throw Luke to the icy ground. The monster grabs the Tauntaun by its neck, killing the poor lizard, then bashes Luke in the face. Unconscious, covered with blood, the young warrior from Tatooine is dragged across the snow by the horrible snow monster. Meanwhile, Han has made it back to the rebel base, and announces to Leia that he must be leaving. The princess and the pirate meet in one of the ice corridors outside the control room. Han explains the reason he has to go, important. He has no choice. It's a mission that he must go off and complete at the end of the film. Han comes on to Leia, but she won't have much to do with it.
She stays aloof of the whole situation and doesn't have time to fall in love. She rejects Han as a rogue and puts him in his place, but she gets a sparkle in her eye and is slightly attracted to Han. The undeveloped and creatively vague motivation of Han here might reveal that this early section, page 2 in fact, was written before the story conferences developed that Han would embark on a quest to contact his estranged mentor figure on behalf of the rebellion. Lucas knew he wanted Han to leave on a mission, but had not yet come up with a reason. The first draft would then adhere to the mentor figure subplot developed in the conferences. Luke, meanwhile, is in the ice monster's lair. He regains consciousness and uses the Force for escape. He's fumbling with the use of the Force. It's not very strong with him. The ice monster is always vague and mysterious. Luke fingers a talisman around his neck and talks about Ben to himself. He feels he must go to the planet described on Ben's talisman. Luke finally shows up at the base and explains the monsters and danger. Here, Ben does not appear and instruct Luke to go to Dagobah. Instead, Lucas came up with the idea of Luke wearing a talisman that used to belong to Ben, with markings that give the name and location of a planet, and by instinct Luke would go there. The blossoming romance between Luke and Leia was much more pronounced in the early material, further reinforcing the notion that they were obviously not supposed to be related. In the treatment, Luke outright proclaims his love for her, but Leia explains that a relationship would be impossible because of her duties. Lucas would write a similar scene years later for Attack of the Clones. Later, Vader uses Leia as bait for Luke, telling her that he knows Luke is in love with her. In the recovery room, Leia takes care of Luke. He is obviously in love with her, and he tries to express this to her. Leia says she can't love him, job, etc., but gives him a sentimental kiss. The snow monsters begin to break into the rebel base and cause havoc, and soon Vader, who is described as waiting at the center of the Imperial stronghold, is revealed to somehow know where the rebels are. The rebel base is attacked by the Empire, and everyone disperses, with Luke and R2 venturing off in search of the bog planet, and Leia, Han, Chewie, and 3PO meeting the rest of the fleet in the Millennium Falcon. Leia gives Han the coordinates for the rebel rendezvous, but when they come out of hyperspace, they are met with an Imperial ambush, are pursued into an asteroid belt, and hide in an asteroid cave, where they have their first kiss. Meanwhile, Luke and R2 arrive on the remote bog planet and meet Jedi Master Minch Yoda. Minch Yoda tells Luke that Ben gave him the talisman he wears around his neck so that he could find him, according to Booze Row. Luke is starving, and Yoda says he has food but won't give him any until Luke starts learning about the Force. The scene discussed in story conferences where Vader is in a castle on a hell-like world does not appear in the treatment, but it is present in the first draft. Possibly, this idea was developed at the end of the conference sessions, while Lucas had already written past that point in the story treatment at the time it was developed. Bouzereau describes it as, "In the first draft, the scene with Vader in his castle is intercut with Luke beginning his training. Vader lives in what's described as a grim castle of black iron that squats on a rock in the midst of a crimson sea. He is feeding gargoyles from a golden bowl, and he suddenly stiffens, frightening even the creatures. He has felt a disturbance in the Force." As Luke trains as a Jedi, Han Solo remembers his friend, Lando Kadar, who lives on a gas planet. They go there, but Leia says she doesn't trust him. It is later learned that he is a clone. Luke, meanwhile, dreams of Vader and takes off to face him, a Jedi Knight by now, using the Force to locate Leia, who has been captured with Han, Chewie, and 3PO, as in the final film. Vader uses them as bait for Luke, who arrives and duels Vader. Han, Leia, Chewie, and 3PO escape and make it back to the Millennium Falcon while Lando eludes the stormtroopers. Luke is tempted by Vader to join the dark side, but refuses and jumps off a ledge and into a debris chute,
where he dangles above the city before being rescued by the Falcon. They land on a beautiful jungle garden planet at the end, where the heroes say goodbye to each other before the Falcon takes off into the sunset. Boozro describes it as, Han, Chewie, and Lando are getting ready to leave. The Wookiee hugs everyone, even 3PO, who thanks him for putting him back together. Han gives Leia a long kiss. The Falcon takes off at sunset. Twin suns low on the horizon as the Falcon becomes a tiny speck, then disappears behind the silhouettes of Luke, Leia, and the robots. The adventure would continue in the next chapter. The basic story of the treatment is fairly similar to what ended up on the screen. Only the details changed, and until the last quarter, the plot is exactly alike. You will notice that there is no I am your father revelation in Lucas's outline, nor would there be in the first draft screenplay. This is the most crucial development in all of Star Wars' story history, and we will soon get to it. The style and tone of the story is also more like Star Wars, rather than the sepulchral undertones that Empire would eventually be known for. The action is constant, the plot moves quickly. There is a much less pronounced darkness compared to the final film, and the story ends on a resolved and relatively light note, and could be said to be a self-contained adventure film like Star Wars. However, a maturity had been introduced into the story, leaving behind the naivete and innocence of the original, and a foreboding atmosphere of danger hung over the characters. In coming up with an actual story for Empire Strikes Back, Lucas turned to a film of Akira Kurosawa's called Dersu Uzala, and filled in the rest using elements from the other Star Wars tales. Luke's confrontation with Vader from Splinter of the Mind's Eye was reprised, and an exciting chase through an asteroid belt from Star Wars' 1974 rough draft was reused as well. A city in the clouds also appeared in the earlier drafts of the first film as the prison complex of Alderaan, which was now reintegrated as Lando's Cloud City. Together, Dersu Uzala and the recycled strands and set pieces from the previous unmade stories, eventually with a romance inspired by Gone with the Wind, and even containing identical dialogue from Margaret Mitchell's novel, would form the skeletal foundation of The Empire Strikes Back. The development of Yoda and most of the Dagobah and Hoth plots stem from Kurosawa's film Dersu Uzala, which had just been released 2 years earlier in 1975, and marked the beginning of Kurosawa's return to popularity, winning the Oscar for Best Foreign Language Film. Based off the famous Russian memoir of the same name, written in 1923, it tells a tale of survival in the Siberian wilderness, where a Russian explorer encounters a tiny Asiatic hermit named Dersu, who lives amongst the woods, has a simple childlike charm to him, and speaks in a broken backwards language. Dersu teaches the explorer about the spirituality of nature and how man can live in harmony amongst it, and ultimately becomes a sort of spiritual guide to him. The film was photographed in panoramic 70mm widescreen and provides the visual and tonal blueprint for the Hoth and Dagobah sequences, as well as a prototype for Yoda and his tutelage of Luke, even down to dialogue in some instances. The film's most memorable scene is a gripping snowstorm sequence where Dersu rescues the unconscious explorer from a blizzard in the Siberian plains, and keeps him alive by stuffing his body in a pile of grass. The poignant and touching film was partially a response of Kurosawa to his depression and suicide attempt only a few years prior, reflecting the director's realization that he had outlived his career and grown frail, manifesting itself in this unique and hauntingly beautiful entry in Kurosawa's diverse repertoire. Dersu Uzala would prove to be an international hit and give way to Kurosawa's renewal in the 1980s. His next film would be the acclaimed Kagemusha, partly financed by Lucas himself. One of the primary themes of the developing Star Wars series was the impending clash between hero and villain, Luke and Darth. The Black Knight had become the central antagonist of Empire Strikes Back, and his inevitable confrontation with the hero was its natural climax. Although here Luke loses his first duel with Vader, he is triumphant in the spiritual sense for refusing Darth's offer of power. As the series developed, the two rivals could grow in strength before finally facing each again. The confrontation of Luke against the black-hatted monster of the series represented Luke facing his destiny, and the ultimate conquering and slaying of Vader would represent his final triumph as a Jedi, and the just retribution of his father's murder. Their connection could become more complicated as the series went on, with a very personal relationship naturally growing in the series. Luke represents the last of the Jedi, and with him the ultimate hope of the Rebel Alliance for victory, for the Force is with Luke. Only Vader could realize this, and it would build into his obsession to complete his mission and finally exterminate the last bastion of the Jedi Knights. Luke's death would mean the death of the Rebel Alliance, just as the destruction of Vader would symbolize the fall of the Empire. It was the personification of the main theme of the series, the elemental struggle between the forces of good and evil. In Lucas's treatment, Vader has become obsessed with destroying the young Jedi, and in a very chilling scene, reaches into the Force to find Luke and choke him as he flees the Hoth base. Luke frantically jumps to hyperspace, escaping the mental grip of the Dark Lord. In the development of The Empire Strikes Back, the ambiguous Clone War was finally fleshed out in some detail. First attached to Lando, but then dropped, and an alternate storyline was settled on, revolving around an army from a remote part of the galaxy that attacked the Republic. This storyline was also tied to bounty hunter Boba Fett, a concept which would be hinted at in the expanded universe material, but ultimately dropped from Episode 2 in its original form. This information is first revealed in the summer 1979 issue of Bantha Trax. Not much is known about Boba Fett. He wears part of the uniform of the Imperial Shock Troopers, warriors from the olden time. Shock Troopers came from the far side of the galaxy, and there aren't many of them left. They were wiped out by the Jedi Knights during the Clone Wars. The newer Boba Fett angle seems to be where Lucas settled regarding the Clone Wars. This background also found its way into Empire's novelization. Fett was dressed in a weapon-covered armored spacesuit, the kind worn by a group of evil warriors defeated by the Jedi Knights during the Clone Wars, author Donald F. Glut wrote. On a related note, the Stormtroopers would be revealed by Lucasfilm a few years later to be made up of cloned soldiers. In the 1981 publication, The World of Star Wars, a compendium of fact and fantasy from Star Wars and The Empire Strikes Back. The creation of an Imperial Stormtrooper. A cloned man is one of a group of genetically identical humans, an assembly line product. He is a thinking man, but he serves a specific purpose and no other. A clone has no mother, only his trainers, and he accepts his fate because he believes it is inevitable. A clone is, physically and emotionally, a normal man. He simply has no human rights and no name. He is the property of the Emperor. This seems to be much different from the original film, where they were implied to be simply recruits from an Imperial Space Academy. In fact, Lucas in 1977 even says,
"Some of the stormtroopers are women, but there weren't that many women assigned to the Death Star."
The developments of Boba Fett as a prominent player in the Clone Wars, and then the stormtroopers as clones, is a curious one, though it does not appear that there is any relationship between the two that implies them to be of the same source as it is in Attack of the Clones. Perhaps we see here a reconstruction of what the Clone Wars may have been settled as, circa 1979. Imperial shock troopers, including Boba Fett, came from a distant part of the galaxy and waged war against the Republic, who in turn created their own clone army of stormtroopers, which were led by the Jedi and defeated the invaders. The few shock trooper survivors dispersed themselves amongst the galaxy, including Boba Fett, who became a bounty hunter. Though the information supporting this reconstruction is slightly sketchy, it may prove to be the first indication that Lucas may have been moving the timeline up, in this case moving the Clone Wars closer to the birth of the Empire, instead of 30 years prior, in order to allow both Boba Fett and the recently revised Darth Vader to participate in it. Darth Vader would be decided in 1981 as being roughly 65 at the time of Return of the Jedi, which is still too young for the original timeline, which places the Clone Wars as roughly 50 years prior to Star Wars. This will be explored in detail in Chapter 8, and later in this chapter. Similarly, although Fett's costume is vaguely reminiscent of a sort of prototype stormtrooper outfit, there is no relation, other than they were both designed by Joe Johnston, and thus reflect his aesthetics. In Episode 2, both Jango Fett and the clone troopers would be linked through conscious design choices, but this is not based upon the initial developments from the 70s. It is reported in The Art of Attack of the Clones that concept artist Chang and Lucas simultaneously recalled old mythology, implying that Boba Fett might have been a stormtrooper. That fusion of ideas resulted in the final approved sketch for the clone trooper, where the designs merge. This, however, is an oversight. The background that Attack of the Clones concept artist Doug Chang and Lucas recall is from the comics and novels, which revealed that Boba Fett is really a man named Jaster Mereel, who was once a stormtrooper but defected after murdering his superior officer and became a bounty hunter. All indication is that the original concept was that Fett was a shock trooper, who were enemies of the Republic in the Clone War and were all but destroyed by the Jedi. The Great Divide. After story conferences ended on December 2, 1977, Lucas finished his Empire Strikes Back treatment, and then Lee Brackett began writing the first draft screenplay. Finally, on February 23, 1978, Brackett finished her first draft of the script, which is essentially identical to the treatment with a few notable elaborations. Tragically, she died from cancer on March 18th. The first item of note at this point is that Star Wars was not the fourth entry but the first, as discussed earlier, with Empire Strikes Back following as the second chapter. During story meetings between Brackett and Lucas, the film was identified as Chapter 2, The Empire Strikes Back, and by the time the second draft was finished, the familiar episode listing was in place. However, it was not Episode 5, as we now know the film to be. The opening crawl read, Episode 2, The Empire Strikes Back. However, after the second draft, the film would be known as Episode 5. So what was it that happened? What occurred that suddenly made Lucas take a major step and add another 3 episodes to the Star Wars story? Obi-Wan Kenobi's tales were already in place, but they were not to be a prequel trilogy. They would either continue in the episode listing, which was not necessarily progressing in chronological sequence at the time of the first draft, as Gary Kurtz explained, or they would simply be a spin-off. From what Lucas says of it, one of the sequels, it appears to be a single standalone movie, tangential to the main Rebel versus Empire plot. The actual prequel story, the prequel trilogy, would not take shape until after the second draft of Empire Strikes Back. It is abundantly clear that at this time Darth Vader was still not Father Skywalker. All Lucasfilm publications are consistent with what Obi-Wan says in the film, naturally. For example, the first Marvel comic annual references an adventure participated by Obi-Wan, Darth Vader, and Father Skywalker together as a threesome. Furthermore, they remain separate in Lucas's Empire Strikes Back treatment, in the story meetings with Lee Brackett, and even in the first draft of the screenplay. Some have tried to claim that Lucas came up with the idea of converting Father Skywalker into Darth Vader in 1977, between the release of Star Wars and the start of story development of Star Wars II. But there is no indication that such a process occurred, and in fact this argument is easily refuted. See Appendix C for more detail. In fact, we can pinpoint the exact month when the milestone event occurred, which would have been after Lucas read Brackett's first draft, completed at the very end of February, but before he finished his own second draft in April, placing the genesis of this idea around March. Brackett herself died on March 18th and was in the hospital sometime before that. Most surprising of all is that in the first draft of Empire Strikes Back, Father Skywalker's ghost appears to Luke while he is training on Dagobah and gives Luke advice. Naturally, when Luke finally faces Darth, there is no father revelation. He beckons Luke to join the dark side. Luke refuses. Vader attacks Luke, and Luke jumps off the ledge. The point of Luke's confrontation with Darth is that he refuses the dark side. Father Skywalker is described as a tall, fine-looking man, and is referred to only as Skywalker. Luke takes the oath of the Jedi from his father. Lee Brackett died only a few weeks after she completed her first draft of Empire Strikes Back, which bears a February 23, 1978 date. Lucas was not happy with the script. Similar incidents had happened when Lucas hired writers to script THX-1138 and then American Graffiti. The vision in his head was so specific and particular that no one else could write it quite the way he wanted.
During story conferences with Lee, my thoughts weren't fully formed, and I felt that her script went in a completely different direction, he explained to Laurent Bouzereau.
When Lucas called Brackett in early March to discuss the script, someone else answered. She was in the hospital. A few days later, she succumbed to her cancer. Lucas said in annotated screenplays,
"Writing has never been something I have enjoyed, and so ultimately, on the second film, I hired Lee Brackett. Unfortunately, it didn't work out. She turned in the first draft and then passed away. I didn't like the first draft script, but I gave Lee credit because I liked her a lot. She was sick at the time she wrote the script, and she really tried her best."
Lucas's dissatisfaction with the first draft of Empire Strikes Back forced him to think of new ways to approach the story, new ways of building the plot and characters. George and Marcia had planned to vacation in Mexico over Easter, which fell on March 26th that year, with their friends Michael Ritchie and his wife. While everyone else sunned themselves on a beach, Lucas was holed up in his hotel room with a pen and paper, more worrisome matters to deal with.
"No matter how much I wanted to get out of writing, I was somehow always forced to sit down and work on the script,"
he confessed to Laurent Bouzereau. With the release date of May 1980 already announced and drawing ever nearer, and no replacement available, Lucas had to write a second draft himself, by hand. But as he sat in the confines of that hotel room somewhere in Mexico, the story strangely came out of him in an unusually compelling manner. Lucas explained to Alan Arnold in 1979,
"I hired Lee Brackett to write the screenplay, but tragically she died right after completing the first draft. Faced with the situation that somebody had to step in and do a rewrite, I was forced to write the second draft of this screenplay. But I found it much easier than I'd expected, almost enjoyable."
In this draft, Father Skywalker's ghost does not appear. In this draft, Darth Vader reveals that he is Father Skywalker. The moment comes during the climactic lightsaber fight on the 128th page of Lucas's handwritten second draft. Luke: "Enough! He said you killed him." Vader:
"I am your father."
The two have been battling all through this dialogue. Luke pulls away at this revelation. The two warriors stand, staring at one another, father and son. Luke:
"That's impossible! It's not true!"
Vader:
"Search your feelings. You already know it to be true. Join me."
This is the first time that this shocking notion appears. What happened? What made Lucas change gears considerably and make such a major change to the story? The answer, simply put, is that it was the easiest story solution. It was a way of tying up multiple story threads which became redundant and all converged. The development of Father Skywalker into Darth Vader is based more on convenience and was in many ways a natural progression of the two characters, given the trajectory left off in Star Wars. During the development of Empire Strikes Back, Lucas had to flesh out the backstory and the character histories in much more detail than the vague notes he already had, most of which he had already given to the audience in the first film. When he looked at the history he had created, he obviously realized that the characters of Father Skywalker, Darth Vader, and Obi-Wan Kenobi were redundant in many ways, and that a more interesting past could potentially be created. Lucas has said he was unhappy with Brackett's draft, and it was obviously hampered by this redundancy issue, made material by the introduction of Ben Kenobi and Father Skywalker together as ghosts. Lucas quickly changed it once he realized what the problem was, and it is one of the few story changes Lucas made from Brackett's draft. In the history of Darth Vader and Father Skywalker, there are enormous parallels. Both were friends with Ben Kenobi. Both were Jedi. Both have a mysterious past, and one kills the other. Their histories converge at a critical point, and where one history ends, the other begins. Similarly, both Ben Kenobi and Father Skywalker were Jedi. Both are father figures to Luke. Both want to mentor him. Both were friends with each other, and both were killed by Darth Vader. This is no surprise. As covered earlier in Draft 3 of Star Wars, Obi-Wan was created to replace Father Skywalker, who had since been rewritten to die in the past, at the hands of Darth Vader himself in the revised fourth draft. But once Father Skywalker was brought back into the story, in ghost form no less, the fact that he and Obi-Wan were the same character became painfully clear. How do you solve these story similarities? The answer for a better storyline thus leapt out at him. Make Father Skywalker and Darth Vader the same person. It was a great twist, and it was so obvious, just sitting there waiting to happen. No wonder Lucas enjoyed writing this draft so much, and he was able to hammer it out in under a month. In fact, so satisfying and successful was this new story that he not only wrote the second draft, but he wrote the revised second draft and the third draft all in April of 1978. Compare that with the year-long struggles he endured for Star Wars. This story was a success from the minute Lucas thought it up. Now, a much simpler and more dynamic history was written. Obi-Wan and Father Skywalker were master-student. Skywalker fell to the dark side, battled his former master, and was horribly wounded before being resurrected as Darth Vader. This seemingly simple change would have enormous consequences for the rest of the series. With this change in character and story, the Star Wars series would irrevocably shift from the Flash Gordon-type serial style to a more epic Dune-type saga, from a storybook-like tale of good versus evil to a complicated chronicle of temptation and redemption. With the second draft of Empire Strikes Back, George Lucas created the basis for the Star Wars saga.
When you're creating something like that, the story itself takes over, and the characters take over, and they begin to tell the story apart from what you're doing, Lucas once explained. And you kind of go with it, and you have to go with it, and it sends you down some very funny paths. And then you have to figure out how to break that apart and put the puzzle back together so it makes sense and is cohesive. But that's the adventure of writing. It's the fact that you're not sure where it's going to go.
Lucas was obviously keen on exploring the issue of Luke's father, especially since it was such a significant story point for Luke's character in the first film. But having already introduced Obi-Wan, it was difficult to explore Father Skywalker in any significant way without bumping against the fact that his character had become somewhat irrelevant, especially now that Yoda was in the story. Once Lucas brought Father Skywalker back into the series, he and Obi-Wan became redundant, as Obi-Wan was essentially a copy of him, a noble, elderly Jedi who is a father figure to Luke and is betrayed by Vader, And suddenly, Dagobah is full of old, noble Jedi ghosts who are basically the same character. To make matters worse, Yoda was created to replace Obi-Wan. He was even based off an early version of him. So really, he too is born out of Father Skywalker in a way. Father Skywalker is killed off, and then turns into Obi-Wan. And Obi-Wan is killed off, and then turns into Yoda. You can see Lucas writing himself into corners and having to invent new story directions. But once the characters were all brought together, the story did not work dramatically. Perhaps the idea of a Jedi Trinity worked better in concept, but once actually implemented in script form, it revealed itself to not be the success Lucas envisioned. Luckily, hardly anything was known about Father Skywalker and Darth Vader, other than they were both Jedi friends of Obi-Wan and that Skywalker was killed by Vader. With the two characters already connected in a way which define both of their identities, with both already sharing many similarities, and with both presented in a mysterious light, it was perhaps inevitable that Lucas would hit upon such a transformation, recognizing the enormous power and resonance of such a development, which was also allowed by the deeper mythological probing that Lucas was exploring in Empire. The vagueness and mysteriousness of Darth Vader and Father Skywalker allowed Lucas to merge the two characters and create a more interesting story dynamic, especially for Luke's arc. This is when the prequel trilogy was formed. It is this monumental event, the merging of Father Skywalker and Darth Vader in the April 1978 second draft of Empire Strikes Back, which prompted Lucas to change Empire Strikes Back from Episode 2 to Episode 5. Now, Lucas had more than simply a backstory to his current films. He had a tale of adventure, betrayal, and tragedy of galactic proportions, a tale which could be a series unto itself. Father Skywalker and Obi-Wan become master student and fight in the Clone Wars, while in the meantime the Republic falls and the Emperor rises to dictatorship. Skywalker succumbs to the dark side, betrays his master, is wounded and resurrected as Darth Vader, and then begins to exterminate the Jedi. Meanwhile, Obi-Wan hides Skywalker's son away, and he and Yoda escape into exile as the Empire takes over, the rebellion is formed, and the galaxy is plunged into civil war. It was now a tale as rich and dramatic as the current one, perhaps more so. It was one much more operatic and epic in scope. Rewriting history. The Emperor would also be a prominent figure in the reconfigured backstory, and with the merging of Father Skywalker and Darth Vader, the character of the Emperor was irrevocably changed, intertwined in it all. In the original film, the Emperor was a Nixon-like politician, a corrupt ruler who had turned a democracy into a dictatorship, one who had manipulated his way into office, bribing senators and rigging elections. Darth Vader joined him as a minion along with the rest of the Sith Knights when Palpatine ascended to office, helping the Empire hunt down the Jedi. The 1976 novelization even implied that the Weasley despot was no longer in control, and that the Empire was instead being manipulated behind the scenes by the Emperor's own advisors. Some have written this off as an addition of Foster's, but the fact that we witness a remnant of this plot point in The Phantom Menace suggests that it was indeed based off of Lucas's then-current notes. Reference: Supreme Chancellor Valorum, in place of the Emperor in this version, is controlled by the bureaucrats, his advisors. As Palpatine observes, "Enter the bureaucrats, the true rulers of the Republic." The novelization also contains a mention that there have been multiple emperors. Kenobi explains, "Vader used the training I gave him and the force within him for evil, to help the later corrupt emperors." This is an interesting statement for many reasons. For starters, it implies that there have always been emperors, even good ones. This has its roots in the first draft of Star Wars, where the Empire was a benign one in which the Jedi served as protectors. In this version, one of the emperors became corrupted and brought fascism to the galaxy. The Sith Knights, basically a mercenary band of warriors and sworn enemies of the Jedi, joined this emperor as enforcers and hunted down their nemeses, who opposed the new tyrannical rule. In this draft,